51 years ago this week, Yuri Gagarin became the first person to orbit the Earth. This hour will mark the event by talking to astronauts aboard the International Space Station about their daily life, like their unique way of brewing a cup of coffee.
You go in and use the toilet, and then this big piece of equipment goes chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga-chugga, and then you go to the galley and you get yourself a bag of coffee. And so I like to refer to this as a coffee machine because it takes yesterday's coffee and turns it into today's coffee.
Also, Ig Nobel MC Mark Abrams is here to tell us about flatulent fish. And when a bridge collapses, we're quick to blame its designer. We'll get to the bottom of engineering failures with Henry Petrosky. All coming up after this break, so stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 51 years ago, on April 12th, Yuri Gagarin became the first human to orbit the Earth. Hard to believe, it seems just like yesterday. Well, we have had 5 decades of experience of living in space. The International Space Station is still called home by astronauts, and there is still lots that we don't know. From the biological, how does living in space affect the human heart, to the agricultural, how do you grow plants so far away from Earth? To the quizzical, how does a flame behave in zero gravity? These are just some of the questions that astronauts aboard the International Space Station hope to answer. And they're joining us on this anniversary to talk about what's occupying their time these days. Joining us from the International Space Station, NASA astronaut and Expedition 30 commander Dan Burbank, NASA astronaut and Expedition 30 flight engineer Don Pettit. Welcome to Science Friday.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Houston Station, we're ready for the event.
National Public Radio, this is Mission Control Houston. Please call station for a voice check.
Station, this is National Public Radio. How do you hear me?
Got you loud and clear. Good to talk to you today, Ira.
That's great. Thank you. We're very happy to talk to you. Can you both hear me okay?
We've got you loud and clear.
We used to say in the old business, 5x5 or something like that when I was a ham radio operator or something.
5x5 works.
All right, let's begin. Let me ask you, Don. First, does the view in space ever get tiring as you look out the windows?
It never gets tiring to view Earth from space or space from space, just like any number of views from Earth, of Earth, never get tiring. To see a sweeping mountain scene never gets tiring. There's something about natural beauty that is inspiring to myself, and I will generalize to human beings.
What question do you get asked most by people, besides the bathroom question? We'll do away with that one. What question do people want to know most about your experience in the space station?
One real common question is what I miss most from Earth being up here for a 6-month mission. And one real astute student asked me the inverse question: what will I miss most from space once I return to Earth? So I thought that was a very clever play on one of the standard questions that people ask you.
Mm-hmm. Dan Burbank, you were recently evacuated from the space station because of what turned out to be a close call with space debris. Give us an idea of what that experience was like.
Well, we actually had a pretty good heads up about it. We've got tracking radars all over the world that keep track of orbital debris, and it's things that are basically, you know, in rough order magnitude, about the size of your fist or bigger. And there are tens of thousands of things that are tracked. And whenever one gets kind of close to space station, if we have ample time, we will actually move the space station. We'll actually do a burn, a debris avoidance maneuver, if you will, and it'll open up that that distance to something a little bit more comfortable. Every now and then, we'll get something that's either small enough that it only crops up very late, or it crops up in such a way that the accuracy is a little bit unknown. And in this particular case, it was kind of a combination of both. There was a lot of uncertainty in it, and it was also very late. There wasn't time to actually do a burn that would have been effective in opening up that distance to something more comfortable. So for us, we talked about it the night before, actually probably a day and a half before, and we knew there wasn't time to do the burn. And certainly in the 12 or so hours leading up to what we call the shelter in place, we discussed what we'd have to do. And from our perspective here on board, it was actually fairly straightforward. We essentially started from the forward part of station, worked our way back aft to where the Soyuz vehicles are loaded, located, and we powered down systems. We and the ground did an awful lot of the systems work there, and we closed all the hatches to isolate as many of the modules as possible from each other, and then we just waited until the closest point of approach with the debris item, and we were each in our respective Soyuz capsules.
Mm-hmm. There have been a couple of big solar flares recently that sent lots of potentially dangerous charged particles toward the Earth. What precautions do you have? Do you have in the space station to shield yourselves from them, and are you in any real danger?
Earth, we're outside of the atmosphere, so we don't have the protection from Earth's atmosphere like you would on the surface of Earth. However, we're still well within Earth's magnetosphere, and that deflects a lot of these particles so that they don't pose a real threat. We do have a higher level of radiation up here, but we're still very much under the protection of Mother Earth, and with very few exceptions, life just goes on normally on space station with or without a solar proton event. And what we do notice, these events bring out wonderful displays of aurora.
Let's talk about some of the interesting experiments that you folks are doing up there. One in particular that interests me is a flame experiment. We all know what a flame looks like on Earth here and how it behaves. But from pictures I've seen in zero G, it looks totally different. And how are you experimenting with it?
Well, one of the racks, this rack right here, is a combustion rack for investigating various combustion processes, where you're looking at the nitty-gritty details of how flames burn. The rack right next to it is a glove box where I currently have a flame experiment set up there. And basically, flames have a healthy appetite for oxygen, and they get that oxygen literally by fanning the flame, and gravity helps fan the flame because of gravity-driven convection. The flame is hot, the hot air rises, cold air rushes in, and that brings fresh oxygen next to the flame. If you try to burn a flame in weightlessness with no air motion around it, it'll burn for a few seconds and snuff itself out. So the whole dynamics of what happens with flames is different in a weightless environment, and so the microgravity environment here on space station is a wonderful place to investigate fundamental aspects of combustion. It's basically another experimental knob we can tweak and help figure out what's going on when something burns.
And you're saying that if you leave the flame to itself, it will snuff itself out. That's something unexpected.
It is, and I was doing some combustion experiments last week where we were burning little spheres of plastic. They were polymethyl methacrylate. It's the clear plastic that you see things made out of. and we were burning spheres of that, and we were going to, we had a fan blowing on it to add convection. We were going to put the flame out by purging it with nitrogen, which should stop the flame. It turns out it didn't stop the flame because the nitrogen entrained enough air in it that it just kept feeding sufficient oxygen to the burning plastic, and what snuffed the plastic out in a matter of seconds was turning the fan off, and the flame consumed all the oxygen around it, and it just went out on its own. And I tell kids, this is the space equivalent of what we tell our school kids of stop, drop, and roll if you happen to catch on fire. But the space version of that is stop and float. And, of course, you don't need to drop because there's no place to drop to.
Very, very interesting. Let's talk about another experiment. Is it true that you have, like, a little distillery up there in space? You're doing a sort of a malt experiment? Are you going to brew some beer or something for us?
I heard about that, but that experiment hasn't made it on space station yet, and I don't really know what the details are. I think it's just bringing some materials up and maybe mashing them and then bringing them back down to Earth. I don't think there's any plans for distilling. However, we do have a distillation process here on space station, a distillation apparatus, and can you guess what we distill with it there?
I'm afraid to ask.
Okay, it's part of what we call our regenerative life support system, which I like to refer to as the coffee machine, and it consists of three pieces of equipment. We have a toilet. We have this big piece of equipment that the toilet is plumbed into, which contains a distillation apparatus, and then we have a galley. And you go in and use the toilet, and then this big piece of equipment goes chugga, 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 and then you go to the galley and you get yourself a bag of coffee. And so I like to refer to this as a coffee machine because it takes yesterday's coffee and turns it into today's coffee. And the key element, one of the key elements in that, is a fractional distillation process. And a normal process like that wouldn't work in a weightless environment because all our stills on Earth require gravity to separate the vapor from the liquid. And this uses rotation. It uses a rotating body to help add centrifugal force to separate the vapor from the liquid and perform the distillation. So it's really a neat piece of engineering research.
Very, 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 very interesting to learn how that works. Dan Burbank, what are you hoping to learn through your integrated cardiovascular experiment?
Well, that's an experiment that's got a lot of different aspects to it, and fundamentally, the main goal is to understand how humans adapt to the weightless environment of space, and how we can mitigate the negative effects of that. So, for all of us here, you know, our bodies are just as strong as they need to be for the environment that we're operating in. So, if we don't exercise and we're on planet Earth, we will get flabby and we'll lose muscle mass. If you're up here in space and you don't exercise considerably, since you're never counteracting the force of gravity walking around as we would on Earth up here, you would lose a lot of muscle mass, you'd lose a lot of minerals from your bones, your heart volume, the size of the heart muscle would get smaller and smaller, and those would all be fine if you were going to live and essentially be a long-term creature of space. But since we're going to return to planet Earth sometime, we'd like to minimize that as much as possible. So integrated cardiovascular kind of looks at a holistic in a holistic way at how the body adapts to here. And we do everything from ultrasound, where we're scanning our hearts and our blood vessels. We've got a lot of exercise components to this. We're doing blood pressure a 24-hour, actually 48-hour electrocardiogram to understand how, from electrical standpoint, how the human body is changing. And all these things will help us leave low Earth orbit and go on into deep space, to go back to the moon long term and to go on to the asteroids and Mars. And I think that's a key part of what space station can do for us.
I had heard that there had been some talk at NASA. I was reading about it this week, and maybe you can talk about it, about using the space station as a simulation for going to Mars, a sort of a a long-term simulation mode of what the trip would be like and how it might affect your body. Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about it right now, and that's a really interesting part of it. You know, one thing that's fundamentally different about what we do here on Space Station and our experience here on Space Station from what it would be like to go to the moon long term and certainly to go to Mars. Now, rough order of magnitude, the moon's about 1,000 times further from the Earth than the space station. Mars is about another 1,000 times further, than the moon is. So you've got a lot of different aspects to what it's like to leave the close confines of planet Earth. Here we essentially have a permanent logistic stream from Earth. If something breaks on station, as you know all too frequently will happen, we've always got the ability to fly new parts. If you're going to the moon, you're going to be there long term. If you're going to Mars, you can't do that. You're going to basically rely on yourself. Now, the psychological aspect of going to Mars, there's another whole wrinkle to that, and that is the time it takes to transmit a signal from Earth to the crew on Mars or vice versa. And you're limited by the speed of light, and it'll be a long, long time. Earth will become vanishingly small. It'll almost be indistinguishable from a lot of the brighter stars, so you'll feel very remote. So the psychological part of it would be kind of an interesting thing. To simulate that on station, that would probably involve essentially introducing a time lag between when the crew calls the ground and when the ground responds. It would involve, potentially limiting the crew's view out the window. So you're not seeing planet Earth. You don't feel physically as close to it. And it might involve even going so far as to letting the crew deal with emergencies and system malfunctions and work their way through them to a greater and a more independent degree than we currently might on Space Station. And there's a lot of discussion about how you might do that. It might be something that would be applicable, but I don't know yet about any immediate near-term concrete steps in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Don Pettit, you're going to be involved in the tracking and capture of Elon Musk's SpaceX commercial resupply ship, which is actually an historic event, the Dragon capsule, in a few days. What's going to be your exact role, and are you looking forward to this?
The short answer to looking forward to it is yes. It's going to be really exciting to have a U.S. commercial-made unmanned vehicle come and a rendezvous with station, and then we will lasso it with the arm and berth it to one of our common berthing ports. And so that is going to be a real neat piece of technology, plus the idea that we can have these vehicles come up and bring needed supplies. So all of that aspect is really, really good. In terms of what we're doing to prepare, Andre Kuipers and I are going to be doing the robotics to lasso the Dragon vehicle and then berth it to one of our ports. And I'll be flying the arm for the lasso part, and Andre will be flying the arm for the berthing to space station. So we're sharing the duties and backing each other up for this approach, a track and capture, and then berthing to station.
Mm-hmm. Having lived, I'll address this to both of you, having lived up there for many months and having prepared so long for your voyage and your life in the space station, what did you find that you were not quite prepared for? What are some of the unexpected things that you say, gee, I can pass this knowledge along to the next person, or I found out more about myself from being up here for this amount of time?
That's a good question, and I've got a little example. One of these small details that you can never train for, and you are just surprised when you come up to orbit that it could be this way. And it has to do with our trash cans, our waste baskets. And we have these really nice waste baskets, and if you open up the lid to put a small piece of something in there, that little small piece of something will just be floating right under that lid. And then the next person opens that lid up, all these little small pieces come floating out and it makes a big mess. And so the waste baskets are great for a big chunk of something, but all these little tiny things, like little pieces of tape and little strings and things like that, you don't want to put them in the waste basket or they just make a mess for the next guy. So what we do is we take one of our little wet wipe containers, which is just like the wet wipes that you use for wiping baby bottoms on Earth, and we use the same ones up here. And they come in a little plastic pouch with a little lid, a little doorway that you can open up. And when we have one of those things empty, we stick it on the wall, and we use it for a small items waste basket. And you can open that little lid, you can put little tiny things in there and close the lid, and you don't need to worry about all of these things swimming out. And I never would have thought that you'd use something like this for a little trash can. And it's an elegant solution to the problem. And these are the kinds of things that you only learn once you show up in space. Mm-hmm. And Dan, what do you think?
I guess if I were to think back on the thing that probably surprised me the most, you know, even having been up here twice on shuttle missions, is how difficult it is to keep track of everything that you have. On a shuttle mission, it's a little bit smaller volume. You do spend time in the station, but you don't spend as much time here that you don't get necessarily exquisitely good about keeping track of things. And up here, you know, the first couple of weeks that we're around, it is so easy for things even that are Velcroed and attached and so forth to just fly away, get bumped and jostled. You know, we joke about, you know, new crews coming on board space station, shuttle crews included, creating a wake of swimming parts and cameras and notebooks and procedures and so forth behind them when they go by. It gets to the point up here where everything that you do, you're constantly thinking, planning, or at least in the back of your mind, how to keep track of everything. And if you're going to take something apart to fix it, for example, keeping track of bolts and washers and nuts and having a little piece of tape staged by and having all your tools organized is something that's kind of part and parcel with your life up here.
One last question. Dan Burbank, you're going to be coming back in a few days. Is adjusting to life back on Earth going to be difficult? Are you looking forward to it, or are you going to be nostalgic about missing the space station?
I think everybody that's had a chance to be up here, I think you're always going to have just a little piece of your heart that's still here, that you're going to miss these views, miss just the nature of life in space. I'm really looking forward to seeing my family again. Family and friends, being able to see them again will be great. The thing that will be really hard is, by all reports, is getting used to planet Earth's gravity and getting used to fighting it all the time. We spend a lot of time exercising up here, but I wonder if it'll ever really be enough to make those first couple of weeks as easy as I hope they would be.
Well, Commander Burbank and Flight Engineer Don Pettit, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you, and welcome back when you get back to Earth. Thank you for joining us on Science Friday from the International Space Station.
Ira, thank you. It was great talking to you today.
Thank you. That wraps it up from here. Thank you, NASA. Thank you,
Station. This
Houston.
Is Houston ACR. Thank you. That concludes the event.
Thank you, National Public Radio Station. We are now resuming operational audio communications.
If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions, we've listened to them, and over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday. A newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show.
Hey, buddy, you wanna buy a bridge? It wasn't built to spec, but I can give you a good price. Of course, we're talking about the Brooklyn Bridge, which you'll learn if you read Henry Petrosky's new book, was built with inferior parts that did not quite live up to the standards the engineer had called for. Yet there it stands, still stands today, because the designer was wise enough to know that stuff happens. My next guest says that it's important to look at structural failures, whether we are talking about the sinking of the Titanic, a space shuttle disaster, a smartphone malfunction. Look at them in a larger context as a system that includes people who both maintain and use the structure. Dr. Henry Petrosky is the author of the new book, To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. He's professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University. He joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Welcome back to Science Friday, Henry. It's always good to have you.
Thank you, Ira. It's always good to be here.
You must be getting a lot of questions about the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, about whose fault it really was.
Well, that's very difficult to pin down to one or two people. This is a system. This is a big ship, a big piece of machinery going out into waters that are dangerous with a lot of people on board, with insufficient lifeboats. There are so many dimensions to the Titanic story, and I think that's one of the reasons that we keep hearing new things about it, and we sometimes change our minds about what we think. One thing seems to me to be sure, and that is that the ship was marketed as unsinkable, and as we know, that was simply not true at all. The chances of hitting an iceberg were slim. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the chance of hitting an iceberg was one in a million, and everybody may have known that, at least implicitly. But that doesn't tell you when an iceberg is going to be hit. It could be hit on the first one in a million sailings or the last. Things like probability are funny. They don't give us very precise ideas about what's going to happen or when it's going to happen. In the case of the Titanic, the fact is that there was some overconfidence, hubris involved on the part of the captain who had the ship going, trying to break a speed record, whereas he was going through waters that were dangerous and known to be dangerous. He had been warned about icebergs. So it was a concatenation of all these things that came together, some chance, some deliberate.
And, you know, a lot of this seems to be the theme of your book.
Yes.
That there are a lot of things going on here, you know.
Yes.
As the title says, To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. What other great give me some examples of other great failures that we have to understand, the design and the failure.
Well, you were talking with the people up in the space station. I talk about NASA failures with the space shuttle, and these are familiar. These are examples that are not unlike the Titanic, actually. The Challenger was not an accident that was not foreseen. The engineers warned the managers that it was a little too cold to launch that ship on that day with a complete confidence that it would return. And they were proven to be right. The seals had been leaking. The engineers knew that, and they expected that they would be leaking on that day, too. The Columbia, which came back in 2003 and disintegrated upon reentry, there were also warnings about that, the questions of foam flying off the external tank and hitting the shuttle as it took off, as it launched from Earth. The engineers again said, well, you know, some of that debris has hit the shuttle's wing, and we really should investigate it to see whether it's been damaged terribly or not, and whether we should have to repair it. But again, basically management overruled the engineers and had an overconfidence. The difference between the perspective of managers and engineers with regard to safety and failure is very, very interesting. Before the shuttle missions took off, the engineers were asked what did they think the likelihood was that there would be a failure of the kind that we now know happened. The engineers said, oh, about 1 in 100. The managers, on the other hand, predicted 1 in 100,000. Now, that's quite a difference, and we know that the engineers were proven to be right.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Henry Petrosky, author of To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. Tell us the Brooklyn Bridge story that I just happened to mention. I thought it was also fascinating about Roebling, who sort of built in extra stuff, right? He built in a safety factor into the bridge.
That's right. What responsible engineering does is it specifies the quality of the materials that go into a structure like the Brooklyn Bridge. Well, in the case of that bridge, the Roeblings owned wire-making factory, and they would have liked to have provided the wire for the bridge's cables because they would have had a high level of confidence that it was high quality. But on a basis of a business decision, the board of directors said, no, you can't use your own wire. You're the engineer. It's a conflict of interest. So the contract for the wire went to someone else whom Roebling warned was not a good producer of wire. Well, everything seemed to be going fine until one day after many deliveries of these reels of wire, it was discovered that there seemed to be some bad wire getting into the bridge's cables. And how was that happening? Because every shipment of wire was tested before it was passed on to go ahead and be put into the bridge. Well, it turned out that the wire supplier was not only had bad workmanship, but also had bad morals, and the rejected wire was snuck into the construction site, and it found its way into the bridge. Well, Roebling, this was Washington Roebling. His decision was crucial at this point. What would he do? Would he take all the bad wire out? Now, that would not only cost time and money, but it would also be very dangerous for the workers. What he decided to do was estimate to the best of his knowledge how much bad wire was actually in the bridge already, and then he added additional wire beyond what was originally designed to be in the bridge of high quality and completed the project that way. To this day, that bad wire is in the bridge.
So if you're going to buy it, beware.
get a discount.
Talking with Henry Petrosky, author of To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. And I got about a minute before the break. Henry, tell us why, after two decades of book writing, you wrote a sequel to Engineer is Human. This is To Forgive Design.
Well, the first book, I concentrated on mechanical reasons why things fail. In this book, I wanted to concentrate on larger questions of systems. Everything is embedded in a system, and that system includes these people, who some of whom are not the best of actors. So I wanted to tell that story. A knee-jerk reaction is when a plane has an accident or something happens. Oh, it was a bad design. That's not always true. In fact, in more cases than not, it turns out not to be true. It turns out that the operators or the inspectors or some person involved wasn't holding up his end of the deal.
We'll talk about more stuff from his book, To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, with Henry Petrosky. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Speak Spanish. Ahora, Science Friday, también en español. Encuentra lo mejor de la actualidad científica hispana y del mundo en sciencefriday.com/español.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking to the venerable Henry Petrosky, author of To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. That's his latest new book. And Henry, I we've talked about the Titanic a bit, but you have a really interesting take on an aspect no one has talked about when we talk about the sinking, and that is, what would have happened if the Titanic did not sink?
Yes, that's a very interesting thought experiment, I think. If the Titanic had not sunk, and in fact, if it had reached New York and then went back and forth across the Atlantic many times, the likely result of that would have been, in my opinion, that competing steamship companies would have wanted to better the Titanic. They would have wanted to build larger ships, faster ships. They would have wanted to build them more economically to make more profit. They would have probably used thinner and thinner steel over time. They might have put fewer rivets in. They would have maybe wanted to get rid of lifeboats altogether because, after all, the Titanic was unsinkable. We're following the design of the Titanic, only we're making it bigger and better. eventually, chances are one of those ships would have struck an iceberg or had some kind of incident in the ocean. And since it had all the inherent flaws of the Titanic, it would have sunk, and probably because it was bigger, with a greater loss of life. This is what happens with cycles of success and failure. When we have a success, a prolonged period of success, we tend to become more complacent. We tend to become overconfident that we're doing it right. We've got it figured out finally. And then, of course, a failure occurs and wakes us up out of our dream. The failure, the wake-up call, then causes us to look more closely at what we've been doing, and we discover that, in fact, we haven't been building perfect machines or systems. We've been building them with inherent flaws.
Is there one system, bridge, tunnel, anything that's waiting to fail that you can warn us about, that's overdue?
I think the history of bridges is very interesting. Over the past century and a half or so, there's been a major bridge failure about every 30 years. So right now, we're looking ahead to about the year 2025, 2030, not too much more than a decade from now. If things follow as they have proceeded in the past, we can expect some kind of big surprise. It'll be a bridge that hasn't failed before. It'll be something that will seemingly come out of the blue, but then in retrospect, looking at it and fitting it into the pattern, it's something we will say, "Oh, we should have seen that coming."
So it'll be a combination of human error and design error.
Yes, generally that's right. You could almost say that a design error is a human error because, after all, it's we humans who do the designing.
Yeah, I recall I covered Three Mile Island, that nuclear accident, 1979, and the investigation showed such a combination of design and human errors there.
That's fairly typical. Most systems, most machines, structures are designed to be somewhat robust so that if some little thing goes wrong, the whole thing doesn't fall apart all of a sudden or blow up or anything like that. But then when humans react to this small irregularity, they sometimes make it awfully worse.
Henry, I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Fascinating book. It's To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. It talks about all kinds of engineering designs and famous failures and Henry Petrosky's unique way of looking at them and explaining it. Thank you, Henry. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Ira. Thank you. Bye.
Up next, some improbable humor. If you're a loyal listener, you know my next guest. He's been a Science Friday regular for 20 years. Every year on the Friday after Thanksgiving, you know that, we play the first annual Ig Nobel Awards. They are awards given to science that makes you laugh and then makes you think. Mark Abrams is the co-founder and the MC of the Ig Nobels. He's also the editor and founder of the Annals of Improbable Research, and he writes a weekly column for The Guardian. Welcome, Mark.
Hello, Ira.
Hi there. Mark is going to join us each month to share with us some of the unusual scientific research he comes across, and I think it's fitting for you to be here, Mark, as we're going to announce the winner of our joke show. I know you have a great sense of humor. At least that's what they tell me. No, I know that you do.
In theory, I'm honored to be here today.
Well, let me go right into our joke show winner. During our annual April Fool's Joke-a-thon, we asked folks to get creative and submit their best punchline to a joke. And the joke began, a climate scientist and a climate change denier walk into a bar. And we asked people to submit their jokes, and boy, did we get some terrific response. Our staff picked the three funniest punchlines as chosen by you folks, and we then posted them on Facebook and asked you to vote for your favorite. And so with Here's the results, ladies and gentlemen. With 209 likes, Joe Wiseman had the winning entry. And here's the joke. A climate scientist and a climate change denier walk into a bar. The denier says, "Bartender, show me your strongest whiskey." The bartender says, "This one here, it's 95% alcohol." The denier slams down his fist and leaves the bar in a hurry. The scientist says, "You know, that's the problem with these guys. You show them the proof, and they still don't buy it." Mark, is that a good one? Did you get it?
Yeah, that would have been my vote. And in fact, it was my vote.
Oh, it was.
Are you going to tell the other two?
I'm going to tell the other two. Here's the second place winner is from Mike Mulhern, his joke is, the scientist surveys the room and says to the bartender, I'll have what 99% of everybody here is having. The bartender turns to the denier and says, how about you? The denier replies, I'll wait to see what the other 2% think. That's sort of a double-edged sword on that joke. And the third place goes to Craig Jarvie, who, here's his joke. The denier orders a beer. Bartender says, bottle? Denier says, nah, draft. I have an incisor that gets in the way. And the climatologist says, that's an inconvenient tooth. Ooh, we need fluoride in our sound effect here. But one of our favorites, I think, came from one of our producers, Christopher Intagliata, who writes this joke and came up with it on the spot. A climate scientist and a climate change denier walk into a bar. The denier says, nice to see you. The climate scientist says, nice to see you too. And, of course, Christopher is not eligible to win anything, but he does accept your appreciation of his humor. So that's that. You can read all of our stuff on our website at sciencefriday.com and point to our Facebook page where the jokes are. And if you wanted, to get on with the jokes. But tell us, Mark, what you've got waiting for us today. You sift through all those great science stories. And you come up with some really interesting findings. Have you got one for us today?
Yeah, I've got all sorts of stuff. Well, people are always sending things in. And again, I think you know what I do. I collect things that make people laugh and then make them think. Mm-hmm. So these are real things that are surprising. They're surprising in a way that's funny and in a way that might get under your skin and into your mind, make you start thinking about them. Mm-hmm. So a couple of things that I've ended up getting involved with also. One is by a team of Italian researchers. We gave them an Ig Nobel Prize 2 years ago. They had these are physicists, and they came up with a mathematical description, pretty simple, showing that within any organization, things work a lot better if you promote people at random rather than by traditional means.
Wow. Just throw darts at a employee list and you get promotions better.
Yeah, well, not go outside and just get right. Anybody who knows nothing. But in effect, they started thinking about this because they had run at random across a book called The Peter Principle, which mm-hmm. was written in the 1960s by a Canadian guy named Lawrence Peter. And you can boil that down to one sentence, which is that people get promoted one level too far. People right. always keep getting promoted until they exceed their level of competence. So what these Italian physicists did was say, hey, we can write that in math. We can write a simple math description and then look at how the math tells us it's going to play out. And that's what they did. And what they showed was that you keep introducing so many bad eggs in there that it's guaranteed that over time the organization, any organization, becomes top heavy with people who no longer know what they're doing. And in fact, you've taken all of your best people and you promoted them to do something else. So the whole level of everything yeah. sinks and sinks. So it's a beautiful, sweet little piece of math. They then extended that recently. They just published another thing, also in a physics journal, where they looked at democracies and about how politicians are chosen. And they showed that pretty much the same thing applies there. In a democracy, things work better for everybody on a whole if some of the politicians are chosen at random. Huh. Now, this may sound kind of absurd, but they also looked at history, and it turned out that when you go back to ancient Greece, to Athens, which was the celebrated, big birthplace of democracy, that's how politicians were chosen. All the citizens, except the ones who didn't want to be part of it, had their names put into a lottery, and people's names were picked out, and they became the legislators. And for centuries, these guys have documented, that's how legislators were chosen, at least often around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's only relatively recently that we've gotten away from that.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Mark Abrams. Tell us an improbable story, the one about the flatulent fish. Do tell us that one.
Yeah, this again started from my point of view with an Ig Nobel Prize. We gave a prize about 8 or 9 years ago to a couple of teams of scientists. They had discovered the same thing looking in different parts of the world. And what they discovered is that herrings, you know, those little fish, herrings, right. Apparently communicate by farting. And they have recordings and film. And by farting, they don't mean exactly what you may think by that. Herrings have a whole separate system connected to the swim bladder where they're pushing air around and sometimes letting it loose. And this is how they rise and fall in the water. And so it's by letting the air loose that they apparently also communicate. And at the Ig Nobel ceremony, one of the teams, who is from Sweden, told us how they got involved with this. And this turned out to be the best part of the story. So this is two Swedish marine biologists, and they study fish, porpoises, whatnot. And about 15 or 20 years ago, the Swedish prime minister, Carl Bildt, was sort of on the warpath repeatedly for years, telling the Swedish public that they were being invaded by submarines from their big neighbor, from Russia. And he kept saying this, and there wasn't really any proof. There was an incident years before that was a sort of an oddball thing, but he kept saying there are submarines, and he kept saying they're even coming into Stockholm Harbor, into our capital. He had the Swedish Navy put microphones in the water in Stockholm Harbor, and they came up with a recording, which sounds like a rapid metallic tapping. And so they thought, and the prime minister thought, okay, we've got proof. Prime minister is planning to get up in public and announce that the Russians are basically attacking us. And to bless this proof, he got a team of scientists, including these two marine biologists, to look at the stuff and write a report. Well, these two marine biologists listened to the recording, and they pretty much said, yeah, that's a very nice recording you've got, but that's not a submarine. That's fish. And give us a little bit of time. We'll tell you what kind of fish.
All right. Let me just interrupt.
Mark, I interrupt to say
this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow with Mark Abrams, interrupting a story, which I hated to do, but I had to. Go ahead. Please.
Okay. Back to the intrigue. So anyway, the Swedish prime minister told the scientists, you're wrong, it's submarines. And he was planning to get up in public and start this big international incident. And the scientists said, go ahead, but if you do that, we're going to get up in public and tell people that, no, it's not submarines, it's herrings, and it's herrings farting. And so the prime minister backed down, never made the announcement. But I'm told by reporters in Sweden that over the years he has continued to tell people that it really is and was Russian submarines. And he's now the foreign minister of Sweden, so he's still in a position of power. Kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah, you know, I wonder if you can visually document, you know, the gas release of any of that stuff and come back with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, I've been with them a few times when they love to do a demonstration. They'll get a freshly caught herring and a dead one by now, and they'll plunge it into a bucket of water and squeeze it. And you can see the stuff coming out and you can hear it. You can do this yourself.
this is
but it's got to be fairly fresh herring.
You can try this at home, and not the pickled kind that you get in the jar, right? It's too late.
Probably
by then.
Not, but I think nobody's tried it with the pickled kind.
I just got a minute left. You tell us about your weekly newspaper column. You talk about a recent one about the laws of stupidity. Quickly.
This is something done by an Italian economist about 30 or 40 years ago. His name is Cipollo. And he wrote a little piece to be funny, but it's also quite true. He called it the basic laws of human stupidity. And these laws boil down to a very few things. One is that there are more stupid people around than anybody will ever estimate accurately. And the other is that there's nothing you can do about them other than become aware of it. They just are a fact, and you better deal with the fact that they're not going to go away and that there is no point to trying to accommodate them. There's no way you're going to prevent them continuing to be stupid. Well, again, these Italian researchers, the one who did the randomness stuff, looked at this and thought, we can write this up as a simple mathematical description. And they did, and it plays out in a simple way, and that's what led them to their paper in a physics journal that says we're better off choosing politicians at random, because otherwise we're all far too prey to this universal plague of stupidness.
Oh, there's what better place to end it, Mark. Thank you very much. Mark Abrams is editor and co-founder of the Annals of Improbable Research, also founder and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize Ceremony and weekly columnist for the Guardian newspaper. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Namisha Serene Anand and Luis Quevedo. Sam Plato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch is our technical director. But Manoli Weatherall is here at the controls in New York. Our iPhone app is created by the folks at Pastime Software. And if you missed any part of it, you can get it on that app, an iPhone or our Android app, or download our podcasts and subscribe to them, audio and video. And we'll have our video pick of the week up there this week also. So you can go to our website, and we'll be tweeting all week at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Support for Science Friday comes from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.